In Guadalajara, three Mod leaders, one black, one white, and one blonde. The Mod Squad Summit of North American Leaders meets to talk about NAFTA, which is kind of odd because...
I didn't just start criticizing unfair trade deals like NAFTA because I started running for president. I do it because I see what happens to communities when factories close down and the jobs move overseas.
But now that he is president, that unfair trade deal is very much on the table. An odd summit in Mexico on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, August 10th. I'm John Hockenberry, flying solo this morning. And go to the website. Stephen Harper is blonde, okay? The Prime Minister of Canada. I'm telling you, I'm serious about this. Coming up this hour, an unusual pair shows up in court today. Bank of America and the SEC both face questions about the Merrill Lynch bonuses. And we look at one of baseball's biggest rivalries. The Yankees swept the Red Sox in a four-game series over the weekend, and I'm not gloating. But first, joining us now, Brett Caldwell, Director of Communications for the Teamsters Union. Good morning, Brett.
Good morning, John.
So do you believe that NAFTA is an unfair trade deal? And if so, will there be any serious discussion of it down in Guadalajara?
We certainly do believe NAFTA is unfair. We've lost a million jobs in the United States, and NAFTA was implemented in 1994. And we believe there will be discussions. We're hoping that the president sticks to his guns and holds Mexico accountable for holding up their end of the bargain.
But it's believed that the treaty will stand, according to the administration, which is very different from what the president said on the campaign trail.
Well, I think the president's been very clear that there are concerns with NAFTA that need to be addressed and that he's going to address them, that it's not black and white issues. It's across the board concerns, and that he's going to take them on step by step, one at a time. So we're hoping that he will. We're going to hold him accountable to that and see how it turns out. But it's still early in the process, early in his presidency. And we've got to see how we can turn NAFTA into our favor, because right now everything's worked against the United States up to this point.
Very diplomatic, Brett Caldwell. We'll be back to you in a moment. He's a spokesman for the Teamsters Union. But first, a look at some top headlines. The Pentagon is adding 50 Afghan drug traffickers to a list of people to be captured or killed, according to our partner, the New York Times. National Security Advisor Jim Jones says the Pentagon will know within a year if more troops are needed in Afghanistan. He says it will take that long to figure out if the U.S. strategy there is working. President Obama, as we mentioned, is wrapping up his visit to Guadalajara, Mexico today. He's meeting with Felipe Calderon, the president of Mexico, and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Summit issues include joint efforts to fight the drug trade and the spread of H1N1 virus. More about that in a moment. And Hawaii is preparing for Tropical Storm Felicia. It's forecast to hit the state late today or early tomorrow. The storm is expected to weaken before hitting land. The Dow kicks off today at 93.10. The S&P starts trading at 10.10. The NASDAQ opens at an even 2,000, and the futures market suggests a flat to negative opening when Wall Street gets going in an hour and a half. The economy is hurting a lot of people, but it hurts the most for people in their mid-careers. We're going to hear more about that later this hour. But what about you? Are you feeling vulnerable because you're at the high end of the pay scale? What troubles you most about the economy, and what difficulties have you had trying to get back in? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. So some genius in the media has coined this summit taking place in Guadalajara, Mexico, as the Three Amigos Summit. So there's clearly a lot on the table. We don't know if they're actually amigos, but this meeting between President Barack Obama, Mexican President Felipe Calderon, and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper is certainly a chance to discuss some pressing issues for all three countries. But the question is a matter of priorities, which is first, and do these three leaders really see eye to eye right now? Joining us now is Diana Washington Valdez, reporter with the El Paso Times, author of the forthcoming book, Last Cartel Standing. She reports on the security situation that has plagued the U.S.-Mexican border over the last several months. Diana, good morning.
Good morning to you.
We also welcome back to the program Joan Grillo, Mexico reporter for Time Magazine. We are also speaking with Brett Caldwell, director of communications for the Teamsters Union, but we'll welcome back him in just a moment. Joan, let's begin with you. It seems to me that from the perspective of Mexican President Felipe Calderon, this summit has got to be all about security and demonstrating to these other two leaders that Mexico isn't coming apart at the seams.
Well, obviously, he has a lot of interest to pursue the security issues, but also Felipe Calderon wants actually to get away from the security issues because the security problem has been dominating his presidency, and he wants to talk about some economic issues as well because Mexico is really being hit by the downturn in the U.S. economy. It exports about 85% of its goods to the United States, and this year Mexico is looking at shrinking about 7% because of the U.S. slowdown and the U.S. lack of demand for Mexican goods.
So what can President Calderon do to encourage U.S. demand for Mexican consumer goods?
Well, that's a very hard thing for him to do. He has to try and work with the United States to keep the American companies investing in Mexican assembly plants and hoping those goods they can sell to the U.S., you know, keep in high demand at the U.S. consumer economy picks up, and that can help resume the same number of assembly plants Mexico is used to on the border area.
So, in a sense, Felipe Calderon is going to be arguing to Barack Obama to actually bring more jobs to Mexico, to actually export jobs to Mexico, to increase the amount of economic activity down there.
That's correct. I think there's a certain concern on this side of the border. The Obama administration, in trying to rescue the U.S. economy, has been promoting very much this Buy America strategy. And whereas Mexico in the last 20 years has very much moved in line to the United States and the kind of this North American partnership. So, you know, they're very much, you know, trying to say, you know, we've got to, you know, keep on this partnership and keep on having jobs on this side of the border and buying North American products, not just United States products.
Diana Washington Valdez, reporter with the El Paso Times, I suspect that your neck of the woods is a scene for this huge cross-border trucking dispute that's been plaguing relations between the U.S. and Mexico for months now. Where does that stand from your perspective, and do you think it's possible for Felipe Calderon to get the subject off of security in this summit today?
Well, the whole trucking issue is a political juggling act. We did have a successful pilot program that was not funded last year that proved to be very successful again. And it also helped to prove that the Mexican trucks are safe. But again, the Obama administration had promised organized labor in the United States that the U.S. trucking industry would be, to an extent, protected, and that's what it's all about. And so Obama's in a position of having to deliver on that promise at the same time reaffirming the NAFTA.
Joan Grillo, where do the Canadians figure in all of this, either in terms of the security question? I mean, there are two borders at question here. Or the question of increasing demand for Mexican goods. Do the Canadians have anything to offer here?
Yes, they do. I mean, there's talk of the Canadians also making some investment of training in Mexican police. They said the Canadian Mounted Police are going to invest some money in training and trying to bring up to standards the Mexican police. There's also other issues between Mexico and Canada, separate from the U.S. and Canada issues. Canada recently made Mexican citizens apply for visas to visit Canada, and that's quite a thorny issue here on this side of the border. They took that move because of Mexicans making false refugee claims to travel to Canada. And that's another different bilateral issue, which is also going to be definitely up for talk at this summit.
All right, Joan Grillo, Mexico reporter for Time Magazine. Thanks so much for being with us. One last question for you, Diana. What is the situation as far as the drug unrest and the battles between the cartels and security forces in Mexico? Have things settled down at all?
Not at all. The violence is unrelenting. As a matter of fact, that'll probably be some of the focus of this border security conference that we're having in El Paso today and tomorrow. And, of course, Homeland Secretary Janet Napolitano will be here tomorrow to address some of the border security issues and make some kind of a policy announcement.
All right, and perhaps there'll be more headlines out of that Napolitano meeting than anything coming out of Guadalajara. Diana Washington Valdez, reporter with the El Paso Times, author of the forthcoming book Last Cartel Standing. She joined us from El Paso, Texas. So it's back to you, Brett Caldwell, director of communications for the Teamsters Union. On this question of a dispute over trucking, Mexican trucks versus U.S. trucks, where do the Teamsters stand?
Well, the Teamsters want Mexico to hold up their end of the bargain. For 14 years, they've been required to meet U.S. standards. They haven't done so. Mexican trucks don't emit the same types of aren't meeting our standards for emitting fuel and emissions. They don't meet our standards for weight distribution. The drivers aren't required to meet the same drug testing or testing for driving that our workers are required to meet in the U.S. It's just across the board, Mexico hasn't raised their standards. There's a simple solution to this problem. Mexico raises their standards. They just haven't done so.
But what do you say to the argument that the Teamsters and other trade union officials in the United States are using this as a symbol of really total opposition to NAFTA and a position where we really would love for NAFTA to go away entirely, and that this is just a symbolic sort of surface issue?
Well, the fact of the matter is our partners in this fight are not other trade unions. Our partners in this fight are advocates for highway safety and public citizen, that this is about safe highways. And when we've seen illegal trucks operating beyond the border zone, the crashes that occur, the deaths that have occurred have been horrendous. And so this is not a matter of politics or economy. This is a matter of highway safety. And our members are on the road. We're the people who see the challenges on the American highway system. And this is about, you know, essentially worker safety for us. But if our members are on the road, they need to have a safe driving environment. And Mexican trucks challenge that.
Right. What are the number of fatalities directly related to improperly equipped Mexican trucks?
Well, there's no real numbers for that because the crashes that we have seen have been based on trucks operating illegally beyond the border zone. So it's not something that the government has tracked. But you've seen,
I guess you just said it was horrendous.
Even as far away as Florida and New York, some of these crashes that have occurred that really show you that the challenges that lie before us.
Well, what about during a time of recession, the fact that this trade is held up at the border is having an impact on businesses in the United States?
It's just not having an impact. I mean, the products are coming across the border. Look, we've lost 1 million jobs since NAFTA was implemented. Clearly, the goods are moving to be produced down south. They're moving across the border to be bought in the United States. That's why as you just reported, there's 7% downturn in the Mexican economy. It's just because we're not buying it, not because it can't get here.
All right, Brett Caldwell, Director of Communications for the Teamsters Union, thanks so much for joining us. Among the people closely watching the summit taking place in Guadalajara, Mexico, between Barack Obama, Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, and Felipe Calderon, the President of Mexico. Someone in the media coined that they were the Three Amigos. But there's nothing silly about the other main issue that's going to be on the table that we want to leave you with before we go. Here's Deputy White House National Security Advisor John Brennan talking about the security issues of swine flu this fall.
I think everybody recognizes that H1N1 is going to be a challenge for all of us, and there are people who are going to be getting sick in the fall and die.
Swine flu, the outbreak in the spring, began in Mexico, and on the table in Guadalajara, Mexico, the three leaders in North America will be discussing how they're going to make arrangements for the expected uptick in swine flu later on this fall.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're going to catch you up on all of your sports in a very dramatic sports weekend that we'll talk about in just a moment. But Louise Story is with us, Wall Street and finance reporter for The New York Times, watching all things financial and economic this morning. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
So today your story begins in court.
It does.
Lost money.
It does. 4 o'clock today, there's going to be a judge in New York who may overrule a settlement that the SEC made with Bank of America. This is about those lavish Maryland bonuses that were paid at the last minute last year before the merger.
So the merger was going on, and apparently Bank of America and Merrill Lynch made some sort of secret deal that was unknown to shareholders. The merger went through. The SEC took a look at it. The amount of the bonuses came out, and there was all kinds of legal action. And this settlement supposedly put it to rest.
Supposedly. I mean, it's very rare to have a judge come out and say, I don't understand the settlement. How did you come to this amount of money? We're going to have a hearing. And the question is $33 million too much or too little? Because on the one hand, Bank of America has taxpayer money. But on the other hand, often these settlements are a lot higher.
Now, let's do some math here. Okay, Louise, the penalty is $33 million, right? And in this environment of, you know, $1.5 trillion here and, you know, $380 billion here in bailouts, $33 million seems like a kind of a low number.
Put it this way, one person at some of these investment banks might get a bonus just for one person of $33 million.
Right. And the bonuses that are in question here are upwards of $1 billion, right?
That's right. We're talking about a few billion dollars that went to, you know, several thousand people.
So on what basis would the judge try to overturn this?
Well, the judge may say that the fine needs to be a lot higher, that in comparable disclosure cases, the fines have been hundreds of millions of dollars. Or the judge may say you shouldn't have a fine at all for a company that's got taxpayer bailout money, because we got to get that money back to taxpayers. And we just don't know what the judge is thinking.
Is it possible that so much water has gone, you know, past the dam that, in fact, this money is irretrievable?
Oh, there's no way to get the bonus money back.
I mean,
there's so many legal issues there. And in fact, this fine is not an attempt to get the bonus money back. It's just an attempt just to warn banks that they better disclose things in the future.
All right, Louise Story, stay with us. We're going to ask you all kinds of questions, Wall Street and financial, every Monday morning here on The Takeaway. So thanks for being with us. But now we go to... That can only mean Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor, is in the studio. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
So I have to be objective here, right? I mean, the fact that the Yankees swept the Boston Red Sox at home can't concern me at all. I cannot be happy about that, right?
Well, not at all. I mean, aren't you a Red Sox fan?
Right. But that is the big story over the weekend. After losing every single game this season to the Boston Red Sox, the Red Sox come into Yankee Stadium 2.5 games out.
Correct.
Right, and get swept 4 games. And the games were dramatic. Take us through each one, if you could.
Well, the first one was sort of a home run derby, and it was an offensive barrage. That set up the weekend where the Red Sox didn't score a run for 31 innings until late last night when they scored in the 8th inning with a 2-run shot by Martinez.
Wow.
It was an incredible game, but I think the game that really set the tone was Friday night. 15 innings, 89 outs.
And it ended this way.
The 2-1. That one's drilled deep to left field. There it goes. That ball is gone. See ya. A walk-off 2-run home run for Alex Rodriguez. And a long night's journey into day is over as the Yankees beat the Red Sox 2-0 in a classic here at Yankee Stadium.
A 15-inning pitching duel ends that way.
So check this out. It's like A-Rod has always been on the fence with New York fans because he doesn't deliver in the clutch.
In the clutch, that's
exactly
right.
Exactly. So it's like A-Rod finally brought the date home and brought her home at 11 o'clock. Maybe a little bit late, maybe a couple minutes late. But, you know, Dad was a little, was happy that she came home, but she didn't have any hickeys on her neck.
Well, honey, okay. Well, on the other side of the coin, the poor pitcher that threw that ball to Alex Rodriguez, is his major league debut.
It was his major league debut. I think for him, it's actually going to be a good thing for him to go down in that fashion, only because he'll know how to not pitch to Alex Rodriguez.
Right. Well, Alex comes through in the clutch. All right, enough Yankees, enough Red Sox.
We're over
the
it.
Yankees, though, are 5.5 games up.
Six and a half games up. And they've never actually lost an AL East lead when they've been that far up.
All right, good to know. The NFL's exhibition season, preseason, got
Correct.
Started over the weekend.
The Bills got trounced by the Tennessee Titans, 13-game winners last season, at the Hall of Fame game, which was also a sort of a Bills party.
And, you know, the Hall of Fame game, what do we look for in the preseason at the NFL? The players are so huge, everyone's tiptoeing around the field to prevent injuries.
Yeah, we just look for the first inning, really. The first quarter, and that's when the starters play. But the real story is about the Bruce Smith and the other guys inducted into the Hall of Fame, which included Ralph Wilson, the Bills owner, who was one of the original owners of the AFL.
So the Buffalo Bills, I guess the takeaway is the Buffalo Bills can't win a Super Bowl, but they can just get all of their personnel in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, you're killing them. You're killing them. The Buffalo Bills, of course, in his time, they won four straight. They won four straight AFC championships. They almost won it four times. But Ralph Wilson's known for being one of his daughter was the first female NFL scout. So that's one of the things that'll go down in history for him.
Wow. So, and the last thing on the Bills, Terrell Owen, right?
Correct. Yeah.
We got to see T.O. in action.
Yeah, man. It was a weird scene. He played good. You know, he had a couple catches in the first quarter. We'll see. I think to me, it's less about T.O. and it's more about the defense. And I think that's the case for across the board. Just one last note about the Hall of Fame. Bob Hayes was inducted finally, posthumously. He was he's the only person ever to win, to have both Olympic gold and a Super Bowl ring.
Wow. So should we ask Louise if she's a Red Sox or a Yankees fan?
What sport is that?
So you are truly neutral.
I'm neutral.
You're totally neutral.
I'm totally neutral.
And the Football Hall of Fame, like, that's way beyond your knowledge horizon.
Way beyond.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are probably some people at the New York Times who can help you with that Yankees-Red Sox rivalry.
The business section's on the same floor as the sports section.
And do you hear them screaming and yelling?
We do.
But you're just quietly counting the bonuses.
Watching the stock
Maryland.
Market, right?
That's right. So what do we look for? What do we look for this week?
Well, if you like rivalry baseball, the Giants and the Dodgers are playing a series this week, and that should be a great one. They're fighting for the NL dominance.
And also, that's all a West Coast thing, right?
Without a doubt, without a doubt.
So it's really going to be possibly West Coast, East Coast in the series.
Most definitely. I think, and also don't forget about the Angels in the AL. Yep, and they are definitely the only other team that the Yankees haven't beat this year. So there's still some more drama in there. And then also at the end of the week, we have in soccer, we have the United States versus Mexico, which is the highly anticipated match that'll see, you know, who has dominance in North America.
Right. Well, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks for all of that. And Luis Story, thanks.
Good morning.
And, of course, some of those teams will be in front of home crowds. Others will be away crowds. Find out from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen at his blog post at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the agenda.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Stay tuned for the agenda coming up, what's on tap this week in Washington and around the world. But first, here's Mark Garrison with your news this morning.
Thank you, John. Coming up, coming up on 33 minutes after the hour. President Obama is in Guadalajara, Mexico right now, meeting with the leaders of Mexico and Canada. They're talking about the fight against H1N1 or swine flu, as well as trade and the drug war.
You keep knocking into that drum on the way in here. You need to stop doing that.
Well, exactly,
why do you keep making that noise? Why do you just come in, knock into
music.
It, and that's the thing.
Oh, you know, you like that. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I always bring my Casio when I'm doing the newscast.
Anyway,
dozens are dead after a wave of bombs in Iraq. The attacks targeted mainly Shiite Muslims, and Asia dealing with two typhoons that have devastated parts of several countries. Also, Tropical Storm Felicia could hit Hawaii late today or early tomorrow. John?
Thanks, Mark.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
Join us to talk the agenda for the week, both in Washington and around the world. In the agenda segment this morning is Chris Hayes, Washington, D.C. editor for The Nation. He joins us from Washington. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, John.
And Jill McGivering, Asia editor for our partner, the BBC, joins us from London. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So let's begin with you, Chris. The president is in Mexico at this North American summit. NAFTA was a campaign issue. It's probably not going to be much of an issue, at least in terms of criticism at this summit. Where do we stand in this summit, which takes place today, and Barack Obama will be back in Washington later on tonight?
Well, I mean, I think there's two things. One is that it's kind of remarkable the degree to which trade has moved to the back burner for this administration as a policy priority. I mean, there have been periods within the last, say, 17 years since Clinton was inaugurated, in which trade was a kind of front of mind issue, and it was sort of racking Washington, D.C. There were debates. We had Ross Perot and Al Gore on primetime debate over NAFTA. All of that seems very distant right now, partly, I think, because the economic issues that are sort of front of mind and pressing on people the most immediately kind of crowd out discussion of trade policy. All of that said, there was a little dust up about the nature of a Buy America provisions in the stimulus package. There's been some complaints from Canada and Mexico on that. And you know, Barack Obama did say he wanted to take another look at NAFTA. Those are words that came out of his mouth while campaigning in hard-hit industrial states during the campaign. And he's going to have to either walk away from that pledge or follow through on it.
Well, there was some rhetoric out of the administration saying that so far the treaty will stand. What that means, I don't know. Maybe we can elaborate on that, depending on the statements that come out of the summit. But listen to this statement over the weekend on This Week with George Stephanopoulos on ABC News from, of all people, Newt Gingrich talking about health care.
There are a substantial number of people who are genuinely upset. The American way is let it hang out. Talk to them. Members ought to go back home, hold as many town hall meetings as you have to, let people get it out of their system, and by September we could have a genuine dialogue.
So Newt Gingrich sort of holding hands, kind of psychoanalyzing the American people. The GOP leadership consists of Newt Gingrich talking about these healthcare town meetings around the country, Chris?
Yeah, well, we're in a strange kind of bizarro world right now in terms of the engagement on the healthcare debate. I mean, you have you know, you have conservatives, very, you know, zealously conservative activists sort of fomenting what used to be kind of new left 60s style Alinskyite protests, you know, shouting down members and kind of causing a ruckus, confronting power, as it were. And you have messages going out from Organizing for America, which is the sort of post-campaign arm of the Obama organization, you know, instructing people to go and be very polite and kind of hug their member very close and tell them how much they appreciate them standing up for healthcare reform. So you have this kind of strange tactical inversion over the healthcare battle, which I think, you know, in the beginning was very effective for conservative, but as the White House is very deft at doing, they've kind of turned it around in this sort of judo move whereby they increasingly are trying to paint the people that are showing up at these town halls as a kind of fronting for big
right.
insurance interests and also as extremists.
Well, both parties may regret their enthusiasm about all the voter turnout in 2008. An engaged electorate creates as many problems as it solves possibly for these politicos used to low voter turnout. Jill McGivering, let's talk about Pakistan for a moment. Here is Jim Jones, the National Security Advisor of the Barack Obama administration, talking about the death or apparent death or possible death of Batullah Masood, the Pakistan Taliban leader, on Friday.
It's important because this is Pakistan's public enemy, number one, if I could.
He controls a very violent aspect of the insurgent problems in on the Pakistani side of the border, and this is a big deal.
Jill McGivering, is this a sign that the U.S. and Pakistan are seeing more eye to eye in both the Afghan battlefield and this so-called battlefield in Pakistan? This was a U.S. drone that conducted this attack on Batula Masood.
That's right, and I think it is. I think there's a sense that previously the U.S. has tended to be more focused on al-Qaeda remnants in these areas, and that Pakistan has been more concerned about some of the Pakistanis, part of the Pakistani Taliban, who are, of course, engaged in carrying out attacks on Pakistani soil, some of those big bomb attacks we've seen in some of the major hotels and so on, in some of the big cities. That is causing huge public concern and great insecurity within Pakistan, frightening away investors and so on, and that's really Pakistan's main priority, you could argue. It's still quite murky, this whole business about whether Batula Masood really has been killed. I mean, the sense seems to be, look, we're like 90% certain, coming from officials, both American and Pakistani, but still some voices within the Taliban who are kind of popping up and saying, nope, he's okay, but no evidence of that yet. So as time passes and there's nothing from him, it's certainly starting to seem like that could be the case. And as we were hearing there, that's a really big deal.
Now, Hillary Clinton is in Africa, and that visit continues this week. She's leaving Angola and going on to the Democratic Republic of Congo. But I'm wondering if an Asian nation is complicating the administration's efforts to get humanitarian issues on the front burner in Africa. I mean by that China, that's making trade deals all over Africa. How much of an obstacle is this for the Obama administration to maintain clout in Africa?
I think it's in the background to all the attempts by Western countries and, of course, the US to engage with Africa. We have seen some changes in the sense that we now have China as the biggest single country investor in Africa. So there's no question in the last few years it's made Africa a huge priority and really targeted some of those countries, mostly trying to get minerals, oil, gas, energy issues, that, you know, trying to fuel its own energy needs, and it sees Africa as a key player in doing
right.
that. But also some shifts. I mean, in the first years, everyone was very critical of China, everyone in the West, I mean, saying, you know, you guys don't have the same responsibilities, you guys are not applying the same kind of standards in terms of things like labor rights. But there's some suggestion that China has really taken that on board
right.
and is trying to modify its stance a bit. And some people even saying, look, this could be a test ground. Here is China becoming a heavyweight in the world, just starting
Indeed.
To emerge as a global power. Maybe Africa somewhere, it tests its strategy.
Well, testing with Hillary Clinton there on the ground at this moment. Chris Hayes, Washington, D.C. editor for The Nation magazine, and Jill McGivering, Asia editor for our partner, the BBC. And that's a global and a domestic view of the agenda this week. Thanks for joining me. There's your agenda. And coming up in this economy, success equals failure. What am I talking about? People who are in their mid-career have been hit hardest in this recession. What can they do? We'll find out coming up in 10.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry with a public service announcement.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
Thank you, Smokey. But do you believe it? I love this story. Smokey the Bear, Smokey Bear, actually turned 65 years old yesterday. The Smokey the Bear campaign that suggested that you, by being vigilant, can prevent forest fires is the longest-running public service campaign in U.S. history. Its history is actually kind of fascinating, and all of the public service campaigns in its wake have benefited from the prominence of Smokey the Bear, but it's hard to find anyone who's more recognizable. Helene Cleveland, Fire Prevention Program Manager for the U.S. Forest Service, joins us from Washington. Good morning, Helene.
Good morning.
So Smokey the Bear is just, you know, as much a part of America as mom and apple pie. How did that get to be the case?
Well, in the early 40s, the advertising council, or at that time the Wartime Advertising Council, the Forest Service and the Association of State Foresters knew that we needed to have some type of promotion to keep forest fires in check. And for in the early 40s, we managed to get an agreement with Disney, the Walt Disney Company, to use Bambi on a poster, and that was so successful that we decided that having an animal character to help promote forest fire prevention would be a good idea, and Smokey Bear was born.
And this was a part of the war effort because lumber was a strategic material at that time, and 22 million acres were being burnt annually. Listen to the advertising back in the 1940s.
Smokey the Bear,
Smokey the Bear,
prowling and a growling and a sniffing the air. He can find a fire before it starts to flame. That's why they call him Smokey. That was how he got his name.
So, Helene Cleveland, you know, I grew up in the late 50s and early 60s, and my sense in seeing Smokey the Bear was that we had an enormously huge problem with forest fires. As a little kid, I just thought that basically the forests were on fire everywhere. Once World War II ended, the need for Smokey the Bear, while still significant, modified. It was a very successful campaign, right?
It was a very successful campaign, but it didn't quite modify because with all of the soldiers and military personnel coming back home and people having a lot of free time in the 50s, the visitor use to our parks and forests had increased tremendously. And with that many people getting off into the outdoors, there was the potential for an increase in the number of forest fires. But because of the Smokey Bear campaign and other campaigns, the number of fires were actually reduced through the 50s and into the 60s till today.
Now, are human-caused forest fires as much of a problem today as they were a generation ago?
Yes, they are. I just pulled the statistics up for this summer, and so far, 89% of the number of fires are caused by people.
And in some sense, though, fires are good for forest restoration. We kind of learned that in the environmental movement, but still, that doesn't mean we should be sloppy in the forests in the United States, right?
That's correct. There are times when fire is an important part of forestry management, fire management, and good for the ecosystem.
But Smokey Bear is working as hard as he ever has. Helene Cleveland, we're going to leave it there, but thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Helene Cleveland is Fire Prevention Program Manager for the U.S. Forest Service. Smokey Bear, 65 years old.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Coming up, we're going to be working it like we do every Monday morning. Our work issue this morning is how come people in this recession, in their mid-careers, are feeling the most vulnerable? We'll explain. But first, Mark Garrison's here with all your news this morning.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour.
You like
theme music? Theme music, good. I like that. We're looking at Afghanistan, where drug traffickers suspected of Taliban ties will now be treated the same as insurgent leaders. A new Pentagon order means troops can capture or kill them at any time. The news comes from our partner, The New York Times, citing a congressional report coming this week. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the Democratic Republic of Congo today. She's addressing the high rates of sexual violence there, among other things. She spent the morning in Angola, where she signed an agreement giving new funding to fight AIDS. Prison officials in Southern California say racial tensions between black and Hispanic prisoners may have caused the weekend's riot at a men's prison east of Los Angeles. At least 250 inmates were injured and 50 were hospitalized. John?
Thank you, Mark. It's Back to Work Monday, which means we're back to talking about work issues as we do on Monday mornings. And in this economy, if you're in your 40s and 50s, you may be particularly vulnerable as layoffs are expected to continue to proliferate through at least the third quarter of 2010. And if you're in the age group 44 to 55, you may be the first out the door, and that may be because you're quite successful, you're high paid, you're really experienced. All those things can actually contribute to your vulnerability in this recession. Beth Kobliner joins us, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
So is it the case, and it's really depressing to contemplate, that success is a form of failure the way the economy is shaking out right now?
There's no question that this recession has hit midlife workers, if we call it that, especially hard, you know, harder than ever. I wanted to be clear that when you compare the actual unemployment rate for people in their 20s, for example, it's worse than it is for baby boomers. But when you look at this group of people, you know, experienced workers who have been in a career 20, 30, 40 years, they're having a rougher time than they ever had ever in the history of keeping statistics on this.
Susan Price joins us now. She's a 49-year-old laid-off professional. And tell us about your experience, Susan, and good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Now, you were paid at the top of your scale at the time that you were laid off?
Yeah, I had been with the company for 30 years, so I had progressed along and was making a healthy salary, yes.
And so in your experience, did that mean it was easy to lay you off because it was a big number off the bottom line?
I don't know how much that, you know, took into it. I think that the company was doing a lot of reorganization. I just recently heard that another group of colleagues, somewhat in the same age group, has just gotten their notice as well. So, you know, not sure if it's money related or point in the career related.
Right. So what's your educational background, if I might ask, Susan?
Sure. I have a bachelor's in business, a master's in organizational dynamics from the University of Penn, and in 3 weeks I will be finishing my MBA at Drexel.
And what's it like to interview for a new job with those kinds of credentials? Do you quietly mention them? Do you wear them on your you know, sleeve like a badge? What do you do?
Well, I have definitely updated my resume to reflect the newness of the MBA and tried to play down some of the other dates, which was some advice I had gotten from some career counseling, and really trying to remove some of the age indicators from my resume.
And that wouldn't include plastic surgery, would it?
No.
All right.
No.
So have you actually done some interviewing and found yourself in a pool of individuals who are not what we would call your peer group?
Absolutely. Most recently, a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed with a local company that is a nationally known organization, and they had a very interesting style where they put all of the applicants in one room together, and the expectation was that we would go through a case study and then present it back to the management group that we would be interviewing with. So literally, you know, putting all those people together that were going to be competing for the same job, there was two women who I would say was under the age of 25. There was a young man that was probably under the age of 28. And then there was somebody that already worked there who was probably in her 30s.
I've seen that show. It's called The Apprentice.
Yeah, that's basically what it was. It was very interesting. And actually, in a lot of ways, it was a really good icebreaker because it got people talking and you got kind of more comfortable with, you know, being there and so forth. So it didn't turn out as badly as I thought it might. But in the end, one of the young women was given the position.
Right. And I would say it's fair to say that you were highly conscious of your age in that environment, right, Susan?
Absolutely.
So, Beth, how unusual are Susan Price's experiences here?
Not at all. And we're seeing, starting with the recession in the early 80s, but really hitting now, the value of tenure, working at a company for a very long time, building up your career there, has started to erode.
And well, not only is it a road, but it has negative value.
Well, to some extent, you know, you look at it, the problem is we're not talking about people now who have, you know, have 18 months to hold on to a job as it was in previous recessions, and you just want to hold on until you get your pension. We're talking about someone like Susan, who has a good 20-plus years left in a very vital
right.
career. So what we're starting to see is people like that look at it as, quote-unquote, an opportunity. I mean, it sounds like such a cliche. Oh, great, opportunity. I lose my job. I have to start all over. But for a lot of people, it really is beginning to look like that. And people like Susan going back to school, going to internships, just sort of turning it upside down and figuring out, okay, how can I move on from here?
Well, Susan, when you make the argument, look, I have two masters. I'm experienced in business. Business is business. Do people kind of roll their eyes and say, yeah, but there's a lot of really strong candidates in their, you know, teens looking at the same job?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But I think also that there's a style difference, and the companies, you know, for whatever reason, as businesses progress, they're looking more at task orientation versus relationship orientation. And
What does that mean?
Well, somebody of my generation, we're about relationships. We're about, you know, knowing the folks that we're working with below us, above us, and laterally. And that's a lot of times how we get work done, is through that relationships, network. There seems to be more of a focus on very task-oriented. Do you know how to do X, Y, Z? The questions are very pointed around very specific kinds of experience and background.
Well, Beth, what kinds of tasks do you think would be particularly marketable in this environment for someone in mid-career?
Right. Well, technology is the obvious one. You know, you got to know how to go on Facebook and to Twitter and LinkedIn when it comes to your own job search. But for somebody, you know, out there, I mean, there's certain fields like healthcare, education, government work. Those are sort of the vital fields that you might want to do a career shift. I'm talking to a lot of people who worked at a company 20, 30 years, like Susan, in, say, a computer company, and then have switched and gone into some environmental work because they were able to get a job there, maybe teaching, that type of thing. So I think we're seeing massive switches in the skill set that people need and what type of jobs they're getting.
Does a person in their 40s ever have a case to make that they're being discriminated against because of their age?
You know, we've seen discrimination cases go up to some extent, but the fact is, first of all, to get severance, a lot of companies now say you have to sign your waiver so that you won't sue for discrimination, so that's kind of, I think, put a damper on that. I think mostly what we're seeing is just a shift, and people now are sort of entering this phase where they have 20, 25 years. They've left this company, not by choice, but because they had to. Now they're trying to figure out what they have to do.
Does retraining work if you're mid-career?
It really does. You know, there's some good websites, Encore.org, where they have internships and job listings and training programs. There's something called Workforce50.com. Employers actually actively looking for midlife career people. Mm. And, you know, going to alumni networks. There's all kind of networking going on. Again, you might want to learn how to do it online. And the other interesting thing is the trend toward temping.
Right.
A lot of people
now,
my gosh, who would do that in their 40s? But now it's something people are considering.
Susan Price, before we go, what are you going to do today?
Today, I actually am interning at a local skincare company, getting some different skills and getting the chance to work with a small organization. So I'll be wrapping that up at the end of August, and then I'll really be jumping into the job search as I'm finishing up the MBA.
Well, Susan, good luck on both the MBA and the job search. Susan Price is a laid-off professional trying to find a job. Also speaking with Beth Koblenner, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. So that's the story for mid-career folks. What about you? Are you feeling vulnerable in this economy? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And we're keeping an eye on how the continent of Africa is becoming the field where the U.S. and China compete.
This could be a test ground. Here is China becoming a heavyweight in the world, just starting to emerge as a global power. Maybe Africa somewhere, it tests its strategy.
What does Africa think about all that? That's your takeaway from the BBC's Jill McGivering. If you want to hear that full interview, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
A word from the wise.
Let's not Rumsfeld Afghanistan. Let's don't do this thing on the cheap.
Rumsfeld? A Republican senator tries to guide his Democratic colleagues in Afghanistan and Pakistan. As the questions mount about the mission, it almost makes you miss old what's-his-name.
There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Nah, maybe not. But known unknowns? That's a good description of the war in Afghanistan right now. What else can we Rumsfeld on The Takeaway?
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, August 10th. God, Rumsfeld, man. Takes me back. I'm John Hockenberry, flying solo this morning. Coming up this hour, cash for clunkers has caused a run on fuel-efficient cars. We talk with a GM dealer who's getting cleaned out. And an upside of the recession, parents who aren't working have more time to focus on their kids' education. But first, we're joined by Nicholas Schmidl, a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of To Live or Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years Inside Pakistan. Nicholas, let me just put it to you directly. Is the mission in Afghanistan right now a known unknown or an unknown unknown?
It's a good question. I certainly think that the affairs in the tribal areas of Pakistan right now, where much of the violence is emanating from, qualifies as a known unknown, in that we've got no idea right now what's happening in the aftermath of the drone strike last week that apparently killed the top Taliban leader there.
That top Taliban leader, Batula Masood. More about that in a moment. Nick Schmidl, stay with us. First, some of the top other stories we're following. 50 Afghan drug traffickers have been placed on a Pentagon list of people to be captured or killed. That's a major shift in policy, and it's being reported by our partner, The New York Times. It's a move to staunch the flow of drug money to the Taliban. Meanwhile, National Security Advisor Jim Jones says the Pentagon will know within the year whether more troops are needed in Afghanistan. He says it'll take that long to figure out if the revamped strategy there is taking hold. Jones also spoke about the U.S. summit with Mexico and Canada, which is going on in Guadalajara right now.
The bottom line is that what affects our bordering neighbors has the potential to affect us all, so we want to be certain that we have the tightest, best possible cooperation.
President Obama wraps up the summit today. He and the other leaders are working to cooperate on issues including the drug trade and the spread of the H1N1 virus. Two storms causing major problems in Asia this morning. Typhoon Itau hit the west coast of Japan today, killing 12 people and causing flooding and landslides. Meanwhile, another typhoon hit China, the Philippines, and Taiwan, killing dozens more and causing 1 million people to have to evacuate. Hawaii is preparing for Tropical Storm Felicia. It's forecast to hit the state late today or early tomorrow. The storm is expected to weaken before hitting land. The Dow kicks off today, 9370. The S&P starts trading at 1010, and the NASDAQ opens at 2000, and trading is expected to be weaker as Wall Street opens its doors in about a half hour from now. The signs are pointing to a better economy, investors say. Fewer job losses in July, a thawing credit market. But are you feeling it? Tell us your story. Are you still feeling vulnerable in this economy? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You bet your life I'm feeling vulnerable. Vulnerable, yeah. Mid-career? I'm in the worst possible situation right now.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Masood was a very bad individual, a real thug, responsible for a lot of violence, a lot of innocent people losing their lives. And I think that if there's dissension in the ranks, and if in fact he is, as we think, dead, this is a positive indication that in Pakistan things are turning for the better.
Not ready to go with it completely, but that's James Jones, White House National Security Advisor on Fox News Sunday, using the name of Batula Masood, the Taliban leader in Pakistan, in the past tense. That's the White House very much claiming credit if, in fact, Batula Masood is dead for a strike by a U.S. drone that we learned about on Friday, and that a number of people are suggesting does mean that Batula Masood is dead. Nicholas Schmidl, a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years Inside Pakistan, is still with us. But Christine Fair, we welcome back to the program. She's in Jalalabad, Afghanistan this morning, senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation. Whether Batula Masood is actually dead or not, this attack certainly had some impact within the Pakistan Taliban. I'm wondering if the headline here really is that there seems to be a large degree of coordination between what's going on in Afghanistan and what's going on in Pakistan. Christine?
Well, on whose part? You mean on the amongst the different insurgents, or do you mean across U.S.-NATO? I'm not really clear who you're talking about. You're talking about coordination.
Well, U.S.-NATO, Pakistan. I mean, I think on the sort of coalition side, Pakistan seems to be in the coalition.
Well, not really. Basically, these drones are actually based in Pakistan's Balochistan. All of the drone strikes have been restricted to the Fata area, not outside of Fata. And, this agreement that Bush and Musharraf forged a few years back that these drone strikes would go forward, there's no reason to believe that this agreement hasn't continued. The reality is the United States had not previously focused upon Massoud until really quite recently. And the reason for that is also clear. While he has created a conducive environment for the raising of Afghan Taliban, he doesn't actually share a territory with Afghanistan per se. So Massoud is really a lesser value to the Americans than he was to the Pakistanis. And so this has actually caused quite a bit of tension between the Americans and Pakistan because Pakistan says, listen, why are you using your assets to only kill your enemies instead of ours? And this undermined a lot of confidence among Pakistanis who then saw the U.S. lack of targeting of Beitullah Massoud as being probative of something more sinister.
So you actually think this contributes to an increase in tension between the U.S. and Pakistan. How's that likely to play out?
No. Actually, you misunderstood what I said. The lack of targeting previously was a source of tension. The recent increased focus upon Beitullah Massoud, I think, is actually a confidence-building measure because it demonstrates to the Pakistanis that we not only take our problem seriously, but we also take their problem seriously. So, I got an email 2 days ago from a colleague of mine in Waziristan. A Pashtun poet, I guess you could call the individual, actually composed a poem, an ode to Mr. Drone. And I think there's been another set of misconceptions that people in Fata did not welcome the drone strikes. In fact, there's been quite a bit of evidence to the contrary, that people who live in the tribal areas have welcomed the drone strikes and certainly have welcomed the most likely demise of Mr. Beitullah Massoud.
So, Christine Fair, let me just ask you finally, does this possibly bode a greater possibility of some sort of dialogue with the Taliban, either on the Pakistani side or the Afghan side by NATO forces or U.S. forces? Or would this be a sign that actually they're more interested in defeating the Taliban militarily than actually opening a political dialogue of some kind?
Well, the problem is that people use this word Taliban interchangeably, and it really obfuscates more than it clarifies. I don't even like dividing them into Afghan Taliban and Pakistan Taliban because, in fact, both are actually a much more complicated assembly of different commanders operating not as coherently as people think they are. So Pakistanis, for example, have been very interested in eliminating elements of the Pakistan Taliban while continuing to support elements of the Afghan Taliban. And in fact, the Pakistan Army had negotiated several deals with Mr. Beitullah Massoud. And many people, certainly in Pakistan, I can tell you from here in Afghanistan as well, had been very suspicious that if the Pakistanis could have gotten Beitullah Massoud to cease and desist from targeting Pakistan, but rather focus upon NATO, Afghan, and American forces in Afghanistan, that they would have called off the fight.
Wow.
So the Pakistanis have, since 2004, have been entering into various deals which have bestowed the militants with credibility and money and all sorts of political cachet that they probably didn't otherwise deserve. But it just gives you a sense of the complex game that Pakistan's playing, continuing to divide the militant landscape into good militants and to bad militants.
Interesting.
Bad militants.
Well, Christine Fair, thanks so much. Senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, speaking with us from Jalalabad, Afghanistan. Listen to this.
If Afghanistan becomes a chaotic situation, it affects Pakistan. So we're going to need more of everything. My message to my Democratic colleagues is that we made mistakes in Iraq. Let's not Rumsfeld Afghanistan. Let's don't do this thing on the cheap.
Continuing now with Nicholas Schmidl, a fellow at the New America Foundation. Nicholas, what Lindsey Graham, that's Senator Lindsey Graham speaking on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, it seems to me that he utterly misreads what's going on in Afghanistan. If Afghanistan becomes a chaotic situation, it affects Pakistan. We were just listening to Christine Fair there. You were as well. It seems to me that Afghanistan is affected by Pakistan now, that it is an unstable situation, and so is Pakistan, and they're mutually unstable right now.
That's right. And I think that the channels of instability certainly flow west from Pakistan rather than flowing east from Afghanistan.
Interesting.
picking up a point that Christine made, you know, the coordination on the intelligence sharing and the drone strikes on Beitullah Masoud, essentially since the inauguration of Obama in late January, have been tremendous. There was apparently an intelligence sharing post that was set up along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, and for a short time, the two circles of sort of top targets for both Pakistan and the Americans overlapped, and Beitullah Masoud was squarely in that overlap.
Wow.
The difficulty now moving forward is that the U.S. has certain Taliban leaders that it's going to want to hit. It's going to feel very confident, very emboldened by this drone strike. And the Pakistani government still sees certain Pakistani Taliban leaders as national security assets and not as national security threats.
Well, that dispute is being played out, and that ambiguity is being played out online as the Taliban officials and insurgents attempt to interpret what's going on with Beitullah Masoud. Nicholas, stay with us. Shir Aka Karimi joins us now, senior reporter with the BBC Pashto service from London. Shir Aka Karimi, what is the sort of dialogue and the chatter online as the Taliban attempt to react to this development that Beitullah Masoud is dead?
Well, actually, just a few minutes ago, I contacted some of our reporters in the area about the Afghan Taliban reaction to Beitullah Masoud, and their answer was, he is Pakistani and it's not belong to us, and we don't want to say anything. So in a way, they don't show any reaction so far, and this means, you know, they are going to distance somehow themselves from the Pakistani Taliban, which is maybe this is political things. Otherwise, you know, Beitullah Masoud and some other of his colleagues like Mangal Bagh and Mullah Nazir, about 3 months ago, they established Tehreek-e-Taliban in Pakistan, which is a very big organization there and led by Beitullah Masoud. And they announced that Mullah Omar as their leader. But so far, the Taliban in Afghanistan, they keep quiet and saying it's not matter for them to talk about it.
Huh. Well, Nick Schmidl, do you think that the NATO coalition and the forces can keep track of which Taliban are pro-Pakistan and which Taliban are sort of independent? And is there any possibility of opening a dialogue on both sides, Afghan Taliban or Pakistan Taliban?
I think that's a good question. I think that everyone knows who the pro-Pakistani Taliban leaders are. I mean, people that were mentioned by the caller from the BBC, people like Mulvi Nazir, who is based in South Waziristan and is primarily, almost entirely focused on fighting in Afghanistan. What the drone strike does in terms of dialogue is offers the same sort of options that a drone strike that would kill Osama bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri would offer to the Obama administration. It offers the Pakistani government options now moving forward. They have killed a symbolic leader. They have ended the narrative of Beitullah Masoud, which he actually formed Tehreek-e-Taliban in December of 2007. And his reign of violence has been going on for about 2 years now. So this ends that chapter.
And is a positive for U.S.-Pakistan relations.
Well, it is in a way. It is in terms of dialogue. It's not in terms of coordination, because now the two groups have got different targets that they want to go after.
Well, thanks so much. Lots to think about there. Nicholas Schmidl is a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years Inside Pakistan. Also, Shir Aka Karimi, who's monitoring the situation for Pakistani websites all over the world, reacting to the Beitullah Masoud, let's just say, drift out of sight. He's a senior reporter for the BBC's Pashto service in London.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. And, you know, it seems easy in hindsight to see what happened as this financial meltdown, which became the recession, transpired over the last year and a half. But I still need Louise Story here in the studio, Wall Street and finance reporter for The New York Times, to help me out. First of all, welcome back. And as I recall, it was about a year and a half ago, the derivative market started to fall apart. Then we saw this sort of spike in energy prices that went crazy through the roof that was fueled by all of these speculators. Then the credit markets froze up, we were told, right? And then the sort of procession of the dreary news on this economy has sort of continued since then, job losses increasing, until last Friday, we get word that maybe job losses are declining at a moderating rate. And so it motivated us to take a look at some of these other suspects in the financial malaise, like the credit markets. Barack Obama said this over the weekend, which I wonder if you could help explain to me.
We've pulled the financial system back from the brink, and a rising market is restoring value to those 401ks that are the foundation of a secure retirement.
So the market numbers I can see, but are the credit markets back to where they were before this whole debacle began?
In some cases, we're seeing a lot of improvement. There were companies last week, for example, that issued debt with interest rates that were the sort you saw before the financial crisis. So that is a good sign for companies, because if they can issue debt cheaply, they can get back to business.
And in many ways, the access to the credit markets is a better indicator of whether employers are going to actually start hiring, because this is how they finance inventories, month-to-month operations. This short-term debt is really the arterial blood of the entire economy.
Absolutely. And they also use debt to do expansions and to do planning for new things that would mean they need to hire new people.
And so they start looking forward. They see the market, a leading indicator of economic activity ticking up is clearly increased use of the credit markets by businesses.
Credit markets were the heart of the crisis, and they'll be the heart of the recovery. And that's why the Obama administration has spent a lot of time on them and is talking about their what looks to be like a recovery now.
All right. What was possible? You mentioned companies issuing record bonds. When you say record, it means low interest rates, right?
Yes.
That means they can.
So one example was, there's a company, Coca-Cola Enterprises. They're one of the bottlers for Coke. And they issued a bunch of debt last week, and you know, the interest rates was back where they were before the financial crisis. And this is very different from what we've seen the last year, where companies would have had to pay prohibitive rates to fund themselves. And so what they did is they put their plans on hold, and they buttressed down, and they laid off people, and they didn't move forward. So if companies can get debt in the credit markets, they may move forward.
Is this because the Fed and the Treasury have flooded the world with money, and so there's money available, and that if that dries up, then poof, we're back to the same problem before?
So certainly the Fed has pulled every trigger it has. They've kept interest rates very low, and they've actually been buying up a lot of kind of debt in the market to help. And one thing that we'll have to watch is, as the Fed ends some of these programs, they said last week they're going to end a program where they're buying some consumer debt out of the market. Will investors step in, and will investors take the place the Fed's been taking? And if not, then that could be a problem.
Can the credit markets function without this huge assistance
from the Treasury and the Fed? Yeah.
Right? John McElhaney joins us. He's a GM and Toyota dealer and chairman of the National Association of Automobile Dealers. He's in Fulton, Illinois. Good morning, John.
Morning, John.
So businesses use the credit markets to finance their inventories. That includes, like, keeping cars on the lot. How are you doing keeping your inventory available to buyers who are coming in to look at cars?
John, we've seen inventories diminish pretty rapidly because of the huge spike in new vehicle sales over the last 10 days to 2 weeks. I guess it's been about 2 weeks now since the Cash for Clunkers program took hold. Going into the period, inventories generally of all manufacturers were pretty low because of the in line with the depressed rate of sales that we've been dealing with for the last year almost. So there's still probably a 30 to 40 day supply, but that's unusually low at this time of the year.
So I'm ready to close the deal on that taupe colored Prius with the economy package. Got anything like that on the lot?
We do not. The Prius is one of the models, the Accent, the Hyundai Accent, some of the very high fuel efficient models that were normally in fairly short supply anyway, have pretty much disappeared. But, you know, there's some in the pipeline. There might be a car that comes in 3 days and we sell it and then we're out again. But some of those areas are deficient right now, no question.
Now, John, can you get on the horn and talk to GM and Toyota and say get those factories starting again and they'll listen to you?
Well, they've done that. You know, production has been ramped up, you know, probably for the last 30 days, but they, you know, they can't react that quickly. It's such a huge undertaking to do that and to start a plant up. But they're running with overtime. In some cases, they're running with extra shifts. And so I think, you know, in 6 to 8 weeks, the problem should be alleviated pretty well.
Well, John McElhaney, Iowa GM and Toyota dealer, thanks so much for talking with us about the cars flying off the lot there because of cash for clunkers and possibly increased demand. Louise Story, that's another leading indicator in the economy, right? Declining inventories?
Absolutely. Now, with the auto industry, we have to question whether this was all real demand or whether there's some kind of fake demand created by this cash for clunkers.
But it's the same issue on the credit markets you were talking about, that
yeah.
The Fed is helping the credit markets.
The Fed is kind of a fake, unnatural force. It's not what normally runs the market. So we'll have to wait and see.
I love fake, unnatural forces. Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for the New York Times, giving us a look at what goes on in the financial world. So the question is to you, are you feeling like the economy is getting better? Are you a leading indicator or are you still feeling vulnerable?
I am Lynn. I am from Detroit, Michigan. I am 46 years old. I am struggling. I have applied for many, many jobs and have not heard anything back. Many, many jobs, I'm overeducated or undereducated. So it is a really depressing time. So just hope for better days.
Well, we wish you good luck there, Lynn. Tell us how you're feeling about the economy, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And Mark Garrison has some more headlines.
Thank you, John. Coming
you
up on 29 minutes after
headlines.
The hour. Yeah, you know,
I
might want to like really get rid of the theme there. President Obama is wrapping his 2-day visit to Mexico today. He's meeting with Mexican President Felipe Calderon and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper to discuss the joint effort to fight the drug trade and the spread of H1N1 or swine flu, among other topics. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the Democratic Republic of Congo today, part of a swing through Africa. She'll focus on sexual assault there. A series of bombings in Iraq have killed at least 48 and wounded hundreds more. Deadliest strike occurred in a Shiite community near the northern city of Mosul. And 10 Italian soldiers are free after being held by Somali pirates for 4 months. Pirates abandoned the ship. Italy's foreign ministry says the pirates got no ransom. John?
So coming up, Mel Martinez is stepping down. Florida senator resigns. What's Governor Chris supposed to do? And what does it mean for the GOP in the swing state of Florida? We'll nail it all down. Just a moment.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
So, good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. The state of Florida knew that its Republican Senator, Mel Martinez, was going to resign after his term ended. But then came this announcement last week.
My priorities have always been my faith, my family, and my country. And at this stage in my life, and after nearly 12 years of public service in Florida and in Washington, it is time to return to Florida and my family.
He announced his resignation immediately and that leaves at least a year left on his term. Joshua Johnson, a reporter and anchor with WLRN Miami Herald News, joins us now. Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning, John. Good to talk to you again.
So, yeah, it's always great to talk to you. I mean, this was a big shocker. Was there any reason given for this immediate resignation?
Actually, it wasn't really much of a shock. I mean, we knew that he wasn't going to run for re-election, and there have been a number of people who said that Mel Martinez, although avowedly conservative, was not really one who fit into kind of the bare-knuckle boxing ways of Washington politics. So it wasn't really a shock to a lot of people and hasn't made a lot of waves over the weekend. As far as the reasons, though, he says it's he wants to spend more time with his family, wants to get back to the private
sector.
Don't
we all? Exactly.
Don't we all, yeah. But, you know, it just seems like Washington politics just didn't really suit him in terms of being on the floor of the U.S. Senate in the middle of the MMA match that is, you know, federal politics.
Now, let's talk for just a second, though, about the possibility that the whole Sotomayor issue of the GOP,
right,
pretty much with a couple of exceptions, seven exceptions, I believe, decided to vote against her, that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back for Mel Martinez. What do you think?
Maybe. I mean, Mel Martinez had been a voice of moderation as it related to issues that are very key for Hispanics. I mean, he broke away a little bit with immigration reform legislation. He voted in favor of Sonia Sotomayor and tried to get his colleagues in the Senate to not be quite so bullish about smacking her around over the Wise Latina comments and so on. So now, I don't know if that's what drove him out. I mean, he is still conservative. He voted against cash for clunkers, let's say. That was his very last vote in the Senate. But what that's done now is it's created a GOP in the Senate that is all white and that has no facial street cred, no facial recognition when it comes to dealing with Hispanics. I mean, there's only one Hispanic in the Senate left, which is Bob Menendez from New Jersey. But now, when election time comes around and they have to deal with this fast growing voting bloc of Hispanics, I think it may be a little bit harder for them to look at the Hispanic community with a straight face and say, hey, we're working for you.
Well, that's the sort of Senate issue, but I'm wondering what the Florida issue is. Is it possible Martinez pulled out because with the GOP in the state that it's in right now needs a little more lead time to possibly compete for this Senate seat because it will be contested in the next go-around?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, there are two Republicans right now who are leading in the race, Governor Charlie Crist and former Florida House Speaker Marco Rubio, have pretty good name recognition. Marco Rubio is, you know, a Cuban-American lawmaker from South Florida, very conservative. Charlie Crist obviously has tons of name recognition, mostly well-liked throughout the state, and has already said he's not going to drop himself in the Senate seat to fill out the term. So I don't know if Florida is quite blue enough to give the red state voters in the state concern, but Florida is always a swing state, so I wouldn't be surprised if there are some in the Florida GOP who are wondering what they're going to do between now and next November.
Well, Al Cardenas, a former chair of the Republican Party of Florida, joining us now, a good friend of Senator Mel Martinez on the line from Miami. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to speak with you this morning.
So can you hear the Democratic political operatives sort of licking their chops at the sudden opportunity in Florida, or is this a lock for the GOP?
Well, now it's all about the 2010 race, and you folks were talking about the primary process in the Democrat Party and Republican Party. It looks at this point like the current governor running for the U.S. Senate, Charlie Crist, has a fairly insurmountable lead in terms of the fundraising, the polling numbers, his popularity over the Democrats and even over his Republican opponent. Obviously, you mentioned Florida's a swing state. Charlie can't take anything for granted, but I don't foresee Mel's early departure as having an impact on the 2010 U.S. Senate race, which seems to be in pretty good shape for Republicans, although nothing's taken for granted.
But let me just ask you, Al Cardenas, I mean, did Mel Martinez pull a fast one here and create an opportunity for the Democrats, or is he actually trying to do the GOP a favor by giving a greater lead time?
Well, I don't believe the governor's going to appoint himself as Mel's replacement, so there's really no advantage politically to his departure. The answer to your question lies in who will replace him. If Mel's replaced by someone who has statewide name recognition in Florida, who's someone whom voters have trusted in the past, such as former Senator Connie Mack or Attorney General Jim Smith or former Speaker Alan Bence, there's a perhaps former Congressman Clay Shaw. There's a group of five or six former office holders who are well known and respected in the state who can step up and do the job. And if those are the kind of folks that the governor intends to appoint, well, I think we should be all right.
Well, we'll find out. Al Cardenas, former chair of the Republican Party of Florida, thanks for joining us. Josh Johnson from WLRN, Miami Herald News. Quickly, any Democratic challenger here?
Yeah, Kendrick Meek is a congressman from South Florida, pretty well known, particularly in the African-American community. He's trying to get on the ballot by petition. So he's kind of crisscrossing the state, getting signatures, getting his name out. So he's kind of the Democratic front runner right now. And I do agree with what Al just said. It's going to make a difference who the governor puts in the chair in the interim, because that will speak volumes to what the GOP strategy is for winning next November.
Well, at the very least, 2010 will be a pretty interesting signal race about what's going on, as if Florida isn't always, like, really interesting. Joshua Johnson, reporter and anchor with WLRN, Miami Herald News. Thanks for being with us. And now, Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you, John. 21 minutes before the hour, 50 suspected Afghan drug traffickers are on a Pentagon list of targets to be captured or killed. That's according to our partner, the New York Times, citing a congressional report coming out later this week. With this policy shift, the Pentagon hopes to cut off drug money that funds the Taliban insurgents. President Obama's national security advisor, Jim Jones, says he won't rule out the possibility of sending more troops to Afghanistan. This is ahead of a report from the top U.S. commander, General Stanley McChrystal, that's expected to ask for more forces. Anthony Cordesman is a think tanker who's advising McChrystal. We've talked to him on The Takeaway before. He tells the Times of London, Cordesman does, it may take 45,000 new American troops to do the job.
Think tanker? He's a professor, I think.
He's at a think tank, Center for Strategic International Studies. So I don't know. Academic, advisor, former Pentagon guy.
Tanker.
He's done a lot of stuff. Smart guy. In any case, Asia's dealing with two powerful typhoons. One storm struck China, the Philippines, and Taiwan and forced nearly 1 million people to flee their homes. A second typhoon battered the western coast of Japan and triggered deadly floodwaters and landslides. And a toy is, again, the box office champ. We had Transformers earlier. Last weekend, G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, number one movie in America. Also, not the only thing new coming out, Julie and Julia. That's Meryl Streep playing Julia Child. That opened in second. So other stuff if you don't want the action figure movies.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Adding to a severe fiscal crisis in the California prison systems, this story over the weekend, a violent riot at a California State men's prison in Chino near L.A. Saturday night involved smashed glass windows. The shards became weapons by the end of an 11-hour incident. A dormitory was burned down, 250 prisoners injured, 55 hospitalized. Racial tensions between black and Latino inmates appear to have played some role in the incident. Joining us now is Solomon Moore, a reporter for the New York Times based in Los Angeles. Good morning, Solomon.
Good morning.
So, you know, I I'm just dipping into this here from New York, but last week there was this judge ruling that insisted that the inmate count be reduced in California to deal with the health care problems in the prison system. Now we get this riot over the weekend. Are they connected? Is this a general feeling of malaise in the prison system?
Well, yeah, they are connected, is what I'm hearing. The main issue in the California prison system at this time is how overcrowded it is. You have a prison system, one of the largest in the nation, that has about 150,000 inmates. And that's nearly double the prison system's capacity. You have some prisons, such as CIM, the California Institution of Men, where this riot took place, where you have double the capacity, double the number of prisoners than the prison was designed
wow.
to hold.
Now, I mean, this really is a situation where the extraordinary growth of prisons and interest in incarceration has not been matched by a growth in infrastructure, and that just sort of stopped all of a sudden.
Well, California had a long prison building boom, lasted for quite a while, and what we're hearing now from policymakers as well as prison reform advocates is that it's just not going to be possible for California to build its way out of this problem. There was a three-judge panel that recently ruled the same thing, that really California doesn't even have time to build its way out of this situation. It really should institute parole reform. Pretty much every prisoner that comes out of California prisons, no matter their offense or what kind of programs they were participating in prison, gets parole, and that's contributed to a large recidivism problem.
Right. Well, then finally, I mean, in the meantime, California has the challenge of dealing with these racial tensions. Are there staff and upgrade of prison personnel that can help with that, or is that something they're going to have to live with?
It's probably something they're going to have to live with. There was a Supreme Court ruling in 2005 that basically prohibited the segregation of inmates automatically. And now it's done pretty much on a case-by-case basis as security demands. But what you have inside the prisons is a culture where, you know, prisoners themselves line up according to gangs, according to geography, and according to ethnicity.
And those tensions are reflected in the fact that the California prisons are on lockdown across the state after racial tensions between black and Latino inmates caused a riot that put 250 prisoners in the injury category, 55 hospitalized. Solomon Moore, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Solomon Moore, New York Times reporter based in L.A.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. So schools around the nation are dealing with fewer resources this fall as kids come back to school. But one resource they may have more of is interested parents. What are schools to do to deal with a wave of interested parents? Find out right after Mark Garrison gives us some morning headlines.
Thank you, John.
Morning,
12
Mark.
Minutes before the hour, President Obama is in Guadalajara right now for a meeting with Mexican President Felipe Calderon and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Among other things, they're talking trade, the drug war, and H1N1 swine flu. Pakistani Interior Minister Rehman Malik says the Taliban in the country's northwest is in disarray following the reported death of top leader Fatila Masood. Malik says al-Qaeda may take advantage of the power vacuum.
The other thing which is a bit worrying for is that Al-Qaeda is getting grouped in the same place, and now they are trying to find out somebody to install him as the leader, as the chief terrorist in that area.
Malik tells our partner, the BBC, that all, quote, credible information, unquote, points to Masood having died last week, despite claims to the contrary by some Taliban leaders. Gas prices are up. The new Lundberg survey shows the price of regular up by nearly 16 cents a gallon in the past 2 weeks. The national average for regular is now $2.64. It's still well below last year's prices. And U.S. banks stand to make $38.5 billion in overdraft fees this year.
It's a stimulus package there
stimulus,
for the economy.
Their balance sheets, yeah.
Thanks a lot, guys. Yeah.
But the new debt. And
it's really helpful.
You know, there has been an increase like this during the recessions from a new study from MEBS. John?
Thank you, Mark. So it's Monday on The Takeaway. That means we're talking about issues that affect families, trying to get a conversation going around the family table. And we're well into the month of August, and back to school is right around the corner. Some districts actually get started in the next week or so. So here to talk about one issue that's pretty important to school districts all over the United States is Valerie Purdy Vaughn's assistant professor of psychology at Columbia University. Thrilled to have you back.
Good morning. I'm glad to be back.
The last story we did with you was about educational issues for young African-American kids.
Yes, it was.
It was a fascinating story, and you can actually podcast and find that when Valerie was on the show last. Also with us is Lindsay Cray, who's a principal at Holabird Academy in Baltimore, Maryland. Lindsay Cray, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so Valerie, let's just begin with you. The possibility is that schools are going to have larger classes, they're going to have fewer resources, they're going to be strapped because local school districts are strapped from coast to coast in the United States. But as the recession takes hold, Is it possible that, at least potentially, there are greater resources on the part of enthusiastic parents who want to use this time and use this opportunity to get involved in their kids' education?
Yes, absolutely. There have been several studies that have come out now saying that parents actually want to be more involved in their children's education, particularly because they have more time on their hands. Having said that, psychology models of stress show that as parents' income declines, their level of stress increases, their mental health starts to erode, and that undermines their ability. So while parents want to be more involved, the stress is also going to hit them as well. So it's a double-edged sword there.
So Valerie Purdy Vaughns is describing a scenario where, Lindsey Cray, you may be having to deal with dozens and dozens of shall we say, mentally questionable, stressed out parents, and that can't be a positive. What do you think?
I think it can be a positive if it seems the studies are saying they might also get more involved, but I think that's important for schools to know because we need to be prepared for that. You know, when parents are stressed and kids come into the building really stressed, and it needs to affect the way our mental health team operates and our understanding of what the real underlying issue is.
You know, a lot of people think that, in fact, it's just as easy as pie for when parents want to get involved in the school. They just sort of wander in and they, you know, find a sign-up sheet, and it's really easy for them to get involved. But in fact, quality parental involvement requires an infrastructure to be in place to make quality use of all of those parental resources. How do you do that, Lindsey?
I think, you know, it starts with a conversation with the parent. You know, if they're going to work in the school, it's got to be fulfilling on both sides for us, but for the parent as well. So it's helpful to know, you know, what the parent's interests are, what they feel capable of doing. And then, you know, we usually start out with, you know, things that involve less interaction with the students, just because that's something that we just don't want to, you know, tinker with, especially if there's a lot of stress on the parents' end. So, you know, if parents are willing to do some photocopying for us, obviously that's needed for us.
But parents have helped to solve some specific infrastructure problems in your school. Tell us the story of how you got a steam table.
You know, I think parents need to know that they really carry a lot of political weight in the system, that school districts really listen to the parents. You know, they are the customer. And so, you know, our parents have really played the part of turning around our school. You know, we were one of the worst schools in Baltimore, and the parents have really found their voice. We've done some community organizing here with the help of our local Industrial Areas Foundation, who have trained our parents in how to ask for things from political people. So, you know, just a couple weeks ago, the parents were complaining bitterly about the cafeteria food, you know, complaining that the kids were going all day without eating, coming home starving. There was no nutritional value. So we had the director of the nutrition office come in, and it was, you know, during the summertime, but we had about 25 parents come out. And after an hour of talking with the Hollabird parents, the director of nutrition was on the phone, calling and having a steam table installed in the school 2 days later, which meant healthy food.
Healthy food, yes, local, indeed. Big impact. Growers. Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Lindsey Cray is the principal at Hollabird Academy in Baltimore, Maryland, describing parental involvement and how it played out there. So Valerie Purdy Vaughns, psychologist or professor of psychology at Columbia University, do parents expect to have instant impact when they get involved in schools, and is that a troublesome issue?
I think that they do expect to have impact. I think that they look at what teachers are doing, and they look at what they're doing at home, and they believe that they can just sort of fill in the gaps. And I agree very much with the principal in the sense that that's not necessarily the first place they need to go. One of the first critical steps, quite frankly, is as parents have more time, they can become visionaries again in terms of their children's education. And for me, that means knowing what their children should be learning that year as well as in future years. And so it's sort of like, you know, saying, do you want to, are you doing your homework? That's sort of one step. Are you doing your homework next week? That's another step. But knowing the scope of what they should be learning in schools helps them to actually diagnose when the school is losing critical services. And that's something that when parents are really busy falls right off the table.
Isn't there a humiliation issue, though, in the sense that a child who's stressed at home might see their parents in the school as a sign of why things are kind of a mess at home?
Oh, that's actually, that. I think that that's a very interesting and important perspective. I think that oftentimes what parents don't realize is that children might see the parents not working, but they don't really have a good sense of what that means. And so you create the meaning. And so one of the ways to deal with this is trying to get a management or hold of your own stress and sort of saying, okay, how do I actually deal with this? And then turning that into a positive. And
so it's more positive for kids to see their parents working in the school productively than just sort of sitting at home being miserable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also think it is a silver lining. I mean, we don't get us wrong, you know, that the recession is having a very damaging effect on parents. But this can be one way to turn it around in terms of more positive involvement. Also, I think it is a critical stopgap as some schools are losing critical resources and you have some very highly skilled parents that could potentially over time step in and fill those services temporarily.
Lindsay Cray, before we go, are you expecting any unusual, surprising parental resources as you think about back to school over the next couple of weeks?
I think we will see an increase in parents wanting to be involved in the building. And I think it's going to take some work on our part to make sure that we're really capturing what they're able to offer so that the kids feel like they're in a safe environment.
A challenge to be sure, but one they're pretty happy about as the kids come back to school. We'll prepare for a wave, if not a tsunami, of parental involvement, motivated possibly by greater free time during the recession. It's a sign of stress, but also a sign of opportunity. Great discussion. Lindsay Cray, principal at Hollibert Academy in Baltimore, Maryland, and Valerie Purdy Vaughn's, assistant professor of psychology at Columbia University, some of the upside and downsides of this new parental involvement. Thanks to both of you. If you want to re-listen to that or share how you might get involved in your school this fall, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Our podcast is on iTunes or at thetakeaway.org. And we want to hear your story. Are you still feeling vulnerable in this economy? Tell us your take at our website, thetakeaway.org, and you can sign up to follow us on Twitter while you're there. And with the reported death of Taliban leader in Pakistan, Batula Masood, here's your takeaway.
The U.S. has certain Taliban leaders that it's going to want to hit. It's going to feel very confident and very emboldened by this drone strike. And the Pakistani government still sees certain Pakistani Taliban leaders as national security assets and not as national security threats.
Nicholas Schmidl, fellow at the New America Foundation, author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years Inside Pakistan. I bet there's a few more than two tumultuous years to go. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.